one good thing after, I guess it's not really that good, but yeah, from once we get past chapter 17, we won't have to jump back and forth anymore because the northern kingdom will be gone. Now, Jeroboam the second was a good case of one prospering in evil to the north. So while he was a king to the north, in the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, the king of Judah, became king. So now we're looking at the south. While Jeroboam is to the north, the people are prospering up in the north, but wickedly. And it seems as it's the calm before the storm. Everything is, God has just finally given them over to their own ways and said, fine, you want riches, prosperity, you want all these things, you can have it. And God is, in a sense, given them over to themselves, and they're doing well. It's kind of like if you looked at it, go, gee, why are they prospering if they're doing so badly? It's because the Lord has finally said, fine. And it's almost like they're being fattened up as an ox led to the slaughter. Now, to the south, under Amaziah, this guy's father, he kind of blew it. He meddled with trouble. He got the kingdom into some difficulty because of going against a battle that he shouldn't have been, that God didn't call him to. And consequently, the whole town is in, the city is in disarray, and around Jerusalem, the protective wall was broken down, treasuries have been raided, hostages have been taken. Horrible situation, and now this guy comes on the scene to become king, and he was 16 years old when he became king, and reigned 52 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jechaliah of Jerusalem. That should give you a little clue, mentioning the mother's name, as to whether this guy was good or bad. As it turns out, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Now, his father was a good king. Just at the end of his life, he blew it. You know, one dumb move, it cost the nation a lot. Except for one thing, which is usually the exception was of these later kings, except the high places were not removed, the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now, just to recap and kind of get a picture here, we're jumping into the middle. If you've just joined us on a Sunday evening, it might be difficult to know exactly where we are. This goes back to the time of the United Kingdom under Saul, then David, then Solomon, when they were strengthened by the Lord. Solomon's, because of his sin, he was prophesied that in his son's time, the kingdom would be divided. And Rehoboam, Solomon's son, acted foolishly. Because of his policy, the kingdom was taken, 10 tribes to the north under Jeroboam the first, and he led them away into apostasy, and not one good king of the 19 kings who reigned over the northern kingdom ever was good. To the south, there were a number of good kings, and you see right here where one king is reigning 52 years, Azariah. In 2 Chronicles, he's called Uzziah, the same king, a little different pronunciation and spelling of his name. But he reigned for 52 years. Now, while he's reigning down in the south, there are over six kings that will reign to the north, each one of them after an intrigue and murder and conspiracy and military coup. It's just a horrible thing going on in the north. But to the south, he's a good guy. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Now, all the kings record about him is that the Lord struck the king, verse 5, so that he was a leper until the day of his death, so he dwelt in an isolated house, and Jotham, the king's son, was over the royal house, judging the people of the land. So that's all you hear about him. If you didn't compare 2 Chronicles, you might not ever know this king was an incredible king. He was a very good king. He had many successes. He conquered Elah at the Red Sea, restored shipping and wealth to Israel. He conquered the Philistines, got tribute from them. He was a genius agriculturally and restored the wall of Jerusalem. He invented a number of towers and different military devices that gave them incredible success. And the only thing we see here is the Lord struck him as a leper until the day of his death. Why? Well, according to Chronicles, the reason was because in his popularity, in the peak of his power, he took it upon himself to go into the temple and offer incense to the Lord, which was only the priest's duty. Now, the Lord never intended the kings to do that. He gave that specifically to the priests, so you see him presuming upon the Lord. He was ambitious. He took on more than he should have. He invaded and intruded into a ministry that God did not call him. And that's okay. It had the priest rebuked him to his face. Don't matter you're the king. Doesn't matter you're a powerful king and you're a great king. Get out of here. You have no business doing that. Well, the king got angry. You know, he got lifted up in pride instead of humbling himself and saying, you're right. You know, I shouldn't be here. And walking out with his tail between his legs, which would have been the safe maneuver, he fought off the priest and just argued and got angry. And the moment he got angry, leprosy broke out on his face. And the priest saw it, and they ushered him out. And indeed, he was quick at that point to run out. He knew something happened to him. And he remained a leper until he died. It's amazing that you can be known in one record of the one mistake you make, or really the result of the mistake or the sin that you commit. It really just puts an interesting light into this. It makes me realize that I want to be sensitive to the Lord's leading in my life. I don't want to intrude into an area that God has not called me. You know, so often it's tempting as God begins to bless certain areas of ministry to get involved in something that maybe you're not that good at. And I want to be sensitive to the Lord. I want to focus on what He's called me to do and not try to think, well, now that we've been blessed in this area, maybe then God will use me here and here and here. I want to be open to His leading, because I see the example here of a king who was not supposed to be in one ministry. He took that ministry upon himself. You know, amazing too, he's isolated. The only thing you have now is he's probably sitting there writing his memoirs to the rest of his death and probably giving his son Jotham direction over the land. But the rest of the acts of Azariah or Uzziah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Azariah rested with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Jotham his son reigned in his place. In the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, reigned over Israel and Samaria 6 months. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, as his fathers had done. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. Amazingly, this guy's name means Yahweh remembers, yet he had nothing to do with God in his own life. Obviously, he had some parental guidance to give him that name, but it didn't stick with his character in his ministry. He only reigned for 6 months. He did evil. And Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him and struck him and killed him in front of the people, and he reigned in his place. Now, this is a common thing that's happening. In fact, during the time of Uzziah or Azariah to the south, to the north, it is a horrible thing that begins taking place. This guy, Shalom, comes on the scene with popular opinion, obviously, in front of the people. He puts Zechariah to death. And Zechariah was the fourth generation of Jehu, which God promised four generations that would reign upon the throne of Jehu's house, and then that would be it. And you find also, he says, the rest of the acts of Zechariah, indeed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of Kings of Israel? This was the word which the Lord, he spoke to Jehu, saying, your son shall sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation. And so it was. So Shalom now conspires against him. Now, obviously, Shalom was not a happening guy, but he was used to bring Zechariah to an end. This is not, of course, the Zechariah of the Bible, not the prophet. Now, the rest of the acts of Zechariah, I'm sorry, verse 13. Shalom, the son of Jabeth, then became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah. And he reigned a full month. He got 30 days out of the deal. Lot he got for his conspiracy. He reigned 30 days. For Menahem, the son of Gadai, went up from Tisra, came to Samaria, and struck Shalom, the son of Jabeth, in Samaria, and killed him, and he reigned in his place. And the rest of the acts of Shalom and the conspiracy which he led, indeed, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. God is basically letting the northern kingdom suffer the consequences of their own decisions. You know, they were very prosperous under Jeroboam. Now everybody's vying for a piece of the pie. Everybody's struggling and striving. There just seems to be anarchy, civil war constantly. If you were there in that regime, in the space of 1 year, you would have seen four kings on the throne, from Jeroboam to Zechariah to Shalom and now Menahem. Then from Tirzah, Menahem attacked Tiphsah of all who were there in its territory, because they did not open it to him. Therefore he attacked it, and all the women there who were with him, he ripped open with child. He ripped open.
So one came, and one city didn't want him, and they didn't open up to him, of course.
Brat, you know, a little kid with a temper, you know, he goes in and just totally wreaks havoc on them. In the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menahem, the son of Gadai, became king over his own reign 10 years in Samaria. So he reigned for 10 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, did not depart all his days from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. It's got to have been repeated at least 15 times so far, that little statement. You'll never forget Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. That's for certain. Well, Pul, king of Assyria, then came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver that he might be with him to strengthen the kingdom in his hand. And to Menahem he exacted the money from Israel and all the very wealthy from each man, 50 shekels of silver, to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land. So he bribed his way out of it by extracting a tax from the wealthy. The rest of the acts of Menahem and all he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Menahem rested with his fathers, and Pekahiah his son reigned in his place. Now this is the only guy in this period of time that's going to actually come to the throne without killing somebody else. You know, he's the only guy that comes to the throne as a son of the king. Pul of Assyria is the same as Tiglath-Pileser. And one thing that's important during this time to recognize, and this is extremely important, is that during this period of time, during these kings, during all this conspiracy and bloodshed and nonsense that's going on, people aimless, God has sent some of his most powerful prophets to this area. In fact, when you do some reading and you read about Amos, the shepherd from Tekoa, who went during the time of Jeroboam, Hosea, during the time of Jeroboam II, and Shalom, and Menahem, he was prophesied. And you remember, Hosea was the guy who was called by God to go and marry a woman that he knew eventually would turn into a harlot. And it was all a type in his life. He married this woman, eventually she played the harlot. She had 2 children of her harlotry, which he gave particular names to. And one of the names he gave to the first child was a prophecy that God was going to put an end to Israel completely. Even so, despite the prophecy, the Lord uses Hosea again after his wife has been out and about with every man in the town and the village. She's finally reduced to being sold as a slave. He goes and buys her from the slave trader and cleans her up, fixes her back up, and takes her again to his wife, to show the incredible patience and mercy of God during this period. And it was really meant to do that. Here this guy Hosea, his life was meant as a sign, as a symbol for God's undying love toward people. Then, of course, Isaiah begins prophesying at Uzziah's death. And in fact, the year Uzziah died in the north, Isaiah begins to, he got his call in Isaiah 6, you see there, where here was a guy who was probably a counselor to the kings, and he's given this message, woe to everybody, woe to you, woe to these people, woe to that, in chapter 5. And then in chapter 6, he has a special meeting with God, and God calls him. And Isaiah's response to the call says, you know, here am I. And God answers the call, gives him the direction. He thinks of himself quite differently after he sees the vision of God. He says, after saying woe is to everybody else in chapter 5 and chapter 6, he sees the Lord and he goes, woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips. And so he gets a call now to prophesy. So you've got these incredibly powerful prophets sounding forth their message during this time, even though the Chronicles and the Kings record such horrible situations going on. Now, Pekahiah, the son of Menahem, now is reigning. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menahem, became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 2 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. Then Pekah, the son of Remaliah, an officer of his, conspired against him and killed him in Samaria at the citadel of the king's house, along with Argob, Ariah, and with who were with him 50 men of Gilead, and he killed him and reigned in his place. So the conspiracy now continues. A military coup is enacted here. And the rest of the acts of Pekahiah and all that he did, indeed, are they written in the book of the Chronicles. Now, in the 52nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, this last year of reigning, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king in Israel over in Samaria and reigned 20 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. How would you like to be the guy? You know, Jeroboam had it made with this promise from the prophet that he would reign and he'd be his sons would be on his throne forever if he reigned wisely. And yet he saw more policy of men more important than obeying God. And now he goes down into our history, repeated over and over again, as the guy who started it all. Now, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, same as Pul, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abel-Beth, Makkad, Jonad, these other names, Gilead and Galilee, Hazor, and all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. So he took all these people, carried them captive. Now, this is not the final time, but this is really, he's come in, he's taken some hostages with him. And Hoshea, the son of Elah, led a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck and killed him, so he reigned in his place. And in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. It's believed that Hoshea was actually kind of a puppet king put in there by Tiglath-Pileser. And now he is reigning. And the rest of the acts of Pekah and all he did, indeed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? But in the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, began to reign. Now we're jumping back down to the south. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Again, his mother's mentioned, and he did what was right. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. However, the high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And he built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. And the rest of the acts of Jotham and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And in those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So Jotham rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. And Ahaz, his son, reigned in his place. Now, the interesting thing I find about each of these guys that are reigning and their children is that you have every conceivable or possible configuration of this. I think I might have mentioned this to you. You have good king that have good children as, you know, good sons to be kings. You have bad kings that have good sons. You have good kings that have bad sons, and you have bad kings that have good sons. Every conceivable possible choice here. So here is a good king who has now a bad son. And in fact, Ahaz is one of the, if not the worst king that ever reigned in the southern kingdom, with the exception of perhaps, I would say, Manasseh. However, at least Manasseh repented later on in his life. Now, Ahaz leads the people into absolute apostasy. God had cleansed the land through Joshua of all the idolatrous nations. 400 years he gave those nations space to repent. 400 years he was patient with those nations to repent. When he spoke to Abraham on that night, promised Abraham that he would give the land to his descendants forever, but that it would not happen right away, that the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet complete, and it would be 400 years before they would take possession of the land. And indeed, that happened. As the time went on through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then the children of Jacob eventually went down into Egypt with 70, came back out that period of time, just about the exact time that Abraham predicted, actually the exact time, they came into the land and took possession of the land. Because God has cleansed them, now God warned his own people. Now, if you commit the same acts that those people did before, I'll do the same thing to you. I'll remove you from the land. Under Ahaz, things start to go down. The northern kingdom, again, it's bad. It's really bad. Things are starting to happen. Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrians, are very strong at this time. Jonah has already prophesied. I mentioned to you, too, that that was I don't know if we edited that out of the tape because I was mistaken. And those of you who did your homework caught me on that one. That Jonah, the son of Amittai, was the Jonah that went to Nineveh that we read in the previous time in chapter 14. But he went during that time when Assyria was at its worst, and God gave them mercy. But now they're starting to stretch forth their arm again, starting to conquer and take people off as captives. Very, very cruel. And now we come to the king to the south, Ahaz, not leading the people any better. Some of the prophets came to the south and said, you know, it seems like you'd learn what happened to the north. And yet you're not learning. And you're doing the same things as your sister Samaria did. And the same thing's going to happen to you. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. And Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king and reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. So he, even himself, is sacrificing his babies. You know, why would he do this? Well, it's believed that he'd, you know, father a number of children through a number of women in his harem, and not wanting to have them rise up to any power, figured, well, I don't want these babies, I don't want these kids to grow up, so we'll just sacrifice them to Molech. And he passed them through the fire, which was the same thing, putting them on this super hot idol and sacrificed his babies. So he's doing the same thing as the abominations of the nations the Lord cast out. He sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, captured Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath. Then the Edomites went from Elath to dwell there to this day. And Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold and that was found in the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's house, sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, took it, captured its people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin. So this act of policy worked out pretty good. Kind of amazing how God, even despite the king Ahaz's attitude and his attitude toward the prophet's message to him, he still gave him some sort of victory over Rezin. It's interesting, though. I want you to turn at this point to Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah began prophesying in the year King Uzziah died, Ahaz's grandfather. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. It was told to the house of David, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim, so his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved to the wind. So in other words, the people were frightened. They heard the sound of battle coming very closely. And the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and Sheer-Jabub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool in the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take heed and be quiet. And do not fear or be faint-hearted for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin in Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against you, saying, let's go up against Judah and trouble it and make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, the head of Damascus is Rezin, and within 65 years Ephraim will be broken, so that it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you will not be established. He prophesies to the southern kingdom, to Ahaz. The northern kingdom in 65 years will be gone. It will not even exist as a nation anymore. Moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. And he said, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Now this is a very popular verse that we all know. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. Now the question comes up, how could this be a sign to him? How would it be possible that what happens later on with the coming of Jesus, the Virgin Mary giving birth to Jesus, his name Emmanuel, God with us, how could that be a sign to Ahaz? Notice what it's saying, behold the virgin. Not a virgin, but the virgin. That's an important distinction. It's believed that something happened in the stars, that the reference here is to some of the configurations of stars, or maybe even the introduction of some star or a planet, that actually would have given a sign to Ahaz at that time, which was a type of the future Son of God to be born. So that in many cases you find this, the near fulfillment and the far fulfillment of a prophecy. The near fulfillment, the temporary thing to prove to the person that the prophet is speaking to, that God is speaking, and then the far fulfillment of which the ultimate fulfillment of what was intended comes to forth, and that is the fact that Jesus would come. And of course, he goes on to describe, verse 17, the Lord will bring Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come upon that day since that Ephraim departed from Judah. So the idea here is before the child shall know how to refuse evil and good, verse 16, the land you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. So something's happening in the time of Ahaz. We don't know. Now, some believe that it's a possible thing in the star. Others believe that it's very possible that there was something that happened distinctive in his time, but you could not call it, I'm sure, the same situation that happened in the time of Jesus. But it's a fascinating thing, and we, of course, are very familiar with this prophecy around Christmas time. You know, and we our thought goes to the Lord coming, and he came born of a virgin, as the Scripture prophesied he would be, and this was the sign to one of the most wicked kings of Israel. How about that for God's grace? How about that? To give this most wicked of kings this incredible promise of deliverance. I think it's a picture of God's mercy. I mean, he sent his own son to a world who eventually would crucify his own son. He sent the prophet Hosea to marry a harlot and then buy her back from the slave market and marry her again as a type of his undying love and affection toward his people. So to me, this is a very powerful picture of the Lord's incredible grace. Here's the most wicked of kings he's sending one of the most powerful prophecies to and promising deliverance. But unfortunately, back to 2 Kings, Ahaz really doesn't get it. He, instead of heeding the advice of the Lord and resting and being still, he hires Tiglath-Pileser. As a result, you see, the end of the prophecy, it kind of ends where the Lord would have established him that he just rested. But since he took matters into his own hands, the Lord still was merciful, gave him victory. But at the same time, eventually, whom he's trusted in, the Assyrians, will be his downfall. Well, King Ahaz then went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And the king Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the design of the altar and its pattern according to all its workmanship. And Urijah the priest built an altar according to all the king Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it before the king Ahaz came from Damascus. And when the king came from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar, made an offerings on it. He burned offering on his grain and his grain offering. He poured out his drink offering, sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on this new altar. And he brought the bronze altar, which was before the Lord, from the porch of the front of the temple, from between the new altar and the house of the Lord, put it in the north side of the new altar. So he kind of put it out of the way. And King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, on the great new altar, burn the morning offering and the evening grain offering and the king's burnt sacrifices, grain offering, with the burnt offering of the people of the land, their grain offering, their drink offerings, and sprinkle on it all the blood of the offerings and on the blood of the sacrifice, and the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. Thus did Urijah the priest, according to all that King Ahaz commanded. Now, I have real difficulty with this. Here is a guy who has just gotten victory over Damascus. He's just defeated them, and he's captured them through the Assyrians. And now he is going to take their gods that he's just defeated and bring down the type of worship into the southern kingdom. I mean, the man has to have his head examined. I mean, God has just given him victory. He's heard the most powerful prophet, Isaiah, give him the prophecy of what would happen. And he does despite that, and he gets the type of this altar for it to be made in Jerusalem. Now, I don't just blame the king here. I think, what was wrong with this priest? Why did he not withstand the king? Was the corruption so bad that everyone was following after this stuff? Urijah the priest is more concerned about his own job, perhaps, and is not willing to do what's right. You know, it's a scary time when those in the church, those called of God, do not stand up for righteousness' sake, even against the political powers that be, if necessary. And it's a very sad time in history, and certainly this was. Well, King Ahaz then cut off the carts, removed the lavers from them. He's dissembling the altar and dissembling the things of worship, the laver, the sea, the bronze oxen that were under it, put it on a pavement of stones, all the implements of the temple. He removed the Sabbath pavilion, which they'd built in the temple. He removed the king's outer entrance from the house of the Lord on account of the king of Assyria. And the rest of the acts of Ahaz, which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Ahaz rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Hezekiah his son reigned in his place. Now we won't get back to Hezekiah till we come to the next chapter. But now we're going to the northern kingdom again. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea the son of Elath became king of Israel and Samaria and reigned 9 years. Did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea, the son, became his vassal, paid him tribute money. The king of Assyria uncovered then a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the city of the Medes. So now they're gone, they're taken, this is it, this is history. Now the rest of the chapter becomes a kind of a post-mortem. Why all these things happened. And this is where this catalog of sins from verse 7 to 20 becomes extremely instructive for us. It was so. God doesn't do things without wanting us to know why. It was so that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they feared other gods. And they walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and the kings of Israel which they had made. Also the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their king, their God, things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. How do you do something secretly against the Lord? I mean, God sees all things. And yet in our mind, you know, that's how sin often deceives us. No one sees, no one knows. And we forget. We've looked this way or that way. Maybe we've pulled down the shade. But God sees us. And so though they're doing it secretly, he sees all things. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high tree and under every green tree. This would have been the phallic symbols and the implements of worship of the Ashtoreth. Sexual orgies, incredible types of ways of worship that the people were attracted to. There they burned incense on all the high places, as the nations had done, before whom the Lord had carried them away before, and did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. For they served idols, of which the Lord had said, "You shall not do this thing." Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, namely every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes, according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets." And he did. He sent them many prophets. We don't have time to go through some of the prophetic messages, but they're powerful. When you're reading the minor prophets, and you're reading some of those that existed during these kings, you see what their message was. You see how powerful God was speaking, and yet the people did not listen. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but what? They stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God, and they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he had made with their father and his testimonies which he had testified against them, and they followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were around them concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. The term idol comes from the Hebrew word, which actually is Hebel, which is, you know, it literally means vanity or worthless. I mean, really, if you think about it, how worthless was it for them to go out into the woods, cut down a tree, cut a portion of the wood out, send it to the artist, and he could fashion this little idol out of it. He'd nail it down so that it wouldn't totter back and forth, you know, get it so it's stable. And just as he gets it just how it's supposed to be, then he takes it home and he worships it. I mean, silly. But what good is that going to do? Yes, you've made ears on that thing, but can it hear? You've given it eyes, because you have eyes, but can it see? So often, that's what people do. That's what idolatry amounts to. We project what God is like, and then we kind of maneuver around him, and you know, we've given our little God eyes and ears, but it's worthless. When we're really in trouble, all of the things that we've trusted in, including the God of mammon, money, will not deliver us. Idols, worthless. Kind of like those electric hot air blowers in the public restrooms, you know, they're worthless. One commentator was mentioning this. He says, you know, he went into one of those things. It said, you know, he's got the three little signs there. Push the button, or first shake the excess water off your hands, then push the button, and then rub your hands together. But he said somebody scratched on the fourth thing. It says, then wipe your hands on your shirt. You know, they're worthless. You know, trivial pursuits, and not just the game, but real life, people are pursuing trivial things. They're spending their life. I'm amazed at some of the hobbies that people will spend their life on, a hobby or something that fills their time, amuses them. It's their master passion. What people will sell themselves for. And God has testified against them. They followed idols. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves molded image and two calves, made a wooden image and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. They caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire, practiced witchcraft and soothsaying, sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to do anger. I would be shocked. I mean, I guess not. I sometimes when I see those psychic numbers on TV, you know, I assume that really only pretty dumb people would call those numbers. And it's a scary thought to think that there might be Christians somewhere just out of curiosity and naively calling them up and wanting to see for themselves, you know, what these soothsayers or psychics could tell them. 98% of that stuff is probably all fraud, but the 2% that isn't fraud, I believe would probably be very demonic. It's like I think a lot, 98% of all signs in the heavens, like UFOs, are probably just can be explained by natural causes. But the 2% that may be there that are inexplicable very well may be demonic causes. And I think it's incredible that people would turn to this. But the people of God, you know, it's kind of like Ahaz led them down the road now that Israel has gone. Israel is being told why they went into captivity. why they were carried away by the Assyrians. But Ahaz at this time is leading the people in the same direction. And you got to wonder, what is it with him? Therefore the Lord was angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. This is where people get the idea of the 10 lost tribes. Judah and Benjamin to the south, the two tribes that held on to the south. In fact, when you look at the idea of the 10 lost tribes, there's a explanation by some that try to explain these lost tribes when, you know, the people, the lost tribes were scattered throughout. And eventually, you know, this is that British Israelism thing that comes through, you know, and tries to explain where these tribes went and what nations they became. And it has really no basis, in fact. In fact, there really aren't 12 lost tribes. Because if you follow down some of the history, you find that many of the people in this area, when Assyria came through, those who were faithful to God migrated down to Judah. And so even though the national aspect, Judah alone remained, many of the tribes, the people from the different tribes, went to Judah and were preserved. In the time of Jesus, you find that people were referring to themselves as from the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe of this, the tribe of that, so they weren't lost. Don't buy into that philosophy of the 10 lost tribes. It really doesn't hold water. God did remove them as a national entity, but individually, people maintained their identity through the centuries. Even to this day, though genealogical records were lost, many Jewish people have a sense about what genealogy or what tribe they're from. So I don't buy that about the lost tribes. But Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, delivered them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. He didn't do this until the last resort. But he tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord, made them commit a great sin, for the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from it until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and the Sepharim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. Now, for 3 years, Samaria was under siege. So for 3 years, they really couldn't even come out of their city. They had very little freedom. The land was really going waste. And now they've finally fallen. They've been taken captive. And now these other people are put in their place, which was the Assyrian battle plan. And it was so that at the beginning of their dwelling there, that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, "The nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them. And indeed, they are killing them because they do not know the rituals of the God of the land." Excuse me. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, "Send there one of the priests whom you brought from there, and let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land." And one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Excuse me. So what you have here, as we've covered in the morning session, is the predicament that the Samaritans now are in, those who will be called Samaritans, with the lions. They've got a problem right now, temporary problem, and what they're doing is they're seeking wisdom. You know, as their idea was of the, thanks Mike, their idea was, you know, each of the gods of the lands had a different, nation. They came into the land, because things aren't working out right, they figure that the national god is angry with them, so they want to do something to appease them, so they get one of the priests they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord or reverence Him. However, every nation continued to make gods of its own, all the different peoples, and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. Now here's where it's really interesting. The men of Babylon made this god by the name of Succoth-Benoth, and this is the Babylonian god of, this is the funny part, of a hen and her chickens. Now, something struck people, the incredible loyalty that a mother hen had over her chickens, and so they had a god there in Babylon that they worshipped. Succoth is hen and Benoth is daughters, so a hen's daughters, and some type of image that represented a hen and her chickens, and they worshipped it. Then the men of Cuth made Nergal. Now Nergal was the deity of the netherworld, similar to Mars, the war god. He looked like a wild rooster. They found many of these gods, most of these gods, in fact, and have traced them to their source. Of Hamath, they made the Ashima. The Ashima is a hairless he-goat, so it would be the image of a hairless he-goat. The Avites made Nibhaz. Nibhaz was a dog-shaped deity, so if you want to worship a dog, you know, you can worship Nibhaz. And Tarkath was a donkey deity, so you can choose between a dog or a donkey if you're the Avites. And the Sepharites burned their children in the fire to Adramelech and Amalek, the gods of the Sepharim. Now, these were Molech-type gods in which they would sacrifice their children to these gods. So the amazing thing is what these people worshipped. You know, it seems like idolatry was a scourge to the people. They could not imagine worshiping a god without some type of an image representing him. And each of these gods had some type of, these images had some type of representation of a strength, and they worshipped. So they feared the Lord. In other words, they reverenced Him by fulfilling certain rituals that the priest from Bethel would teach them, who He Himself was not really right on, because He had learned after Jeroboam. And so in their mind, Israel was just like any other god. They feared the Lord. From every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. They feared the Lord, yet served their own gods according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried away. To this day, they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes or their ordinances or the law or the commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom He named Israel, with whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, "You shall not fear other gods, nor bow down to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them." You know, God made it very plain, all the way through His word to His people, sending prophet after prophet, expressing His heart, patiently waiting for them to turn back. But year by year, from time to time, they'd have a good king in the south, but still things are progressing just as bad down to the south. But now they find in the north the kingdom is taken away. You would think this would have been a very strong object lesson for Judah. Hey, look what's happened. They didn't follow the Lord. Here's the message of the prophets, and God did to them exactly what He said. To Ahaz, hey, 65 years, they're going to be gone. Prophecy is complete. You would think the children of Judah would know what's happening. You would think we would learn. God is faithful. Every word of His prophecy is fulfilled. But the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt with great power and outstretched arm, Him you shall fear, Him you shall worship, and to Him you shall offer sacrifice. And the statutes, the ordinances, the law, and the commandments which He wrote for you, you shall be careful to observe forever. You shall not fear other gods. And the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, nor shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God you shall fear, and He will deliver you from His hand of all your enemies. However, they did not obey, but they followed their former rituals. They had enacted a religion of fear. They'd never have trouble with the lions, but it really didn't cut the mustard for them. The religion of form. They practiced the appropriate rituals they thought would do the trick, and it was really just a religion of accommodation adapted to the culture as needed. So they feared the Lord, yet served their carved images. Also their children and their children's children have continued doing as their fathers did, even to this day. Well, it's a tough thing to go through to see this record, but one thing's good. We won't have to get confused with the northern or the southern kingdom anymore. From here on out, God is going to deal with Judah, the southern kingdom, and God is going to give them reprieve. At this time, Assyria is very, very powerful, but they're going to come up against a king in Judah, one who was very weak in his own mind, and therefore God made him very strong, Hezekiah. One of my favorite kings, a guy that stood up and learned what it was. In fact, understanding a little bit about prayer and expression, I mean, you've got to read a little bit. Maybe if you read the record in Kings in chapter 18, you can also read the record in the Chronicles to get this idea of how he communicated. The same chapters in the Chronicles about Hezekiah are also repeated on Isaiah. Isaiah records almost verbatim in two of the chapters, the same things. It seems like God really wanted us to know a little bit about this king and how he saved the entire nation from the Assyrian assault. And imagine what you would do as a small nation surrounded by 180,000 trained warriors of the Assyrians and the commander telling you that every other nation has fallen to them and you're not going to be any different. And what are you going to do? Hezekiah prays. And it's a fascinating thing to read ahead and check out to see what the Lord does. Imagine what you would do as a small nation surrounded by 180,000 trained warriors of the Assyrians and the commander telling you that every other nation has fallen to them and you're not going to be any different. And what are you going to do? Hezekiah prays. And it's a fascinating thing to read ahead and check out to see what the Lord does. Let's pray. Father, we pray that we might gain wisdom from the lesson of Samaria, the lesson of the northern kingdom, the lesson from the southern kingdom. We see all these things happening, and it's hard for us sometimes to keep them straight, but we know one thing. Those who obeyed you and trusted you, you were faithful to deliver. But you are also faithful, very faithful, to discipline those who disobeyed. And yet in your mercies, you did not discipline them all at once. You sent warning after warning, prophet after prophet. Lord, we see in this an example of the hardened heart of man. How deceitful our heart is. Lord, I pray that we might learn from this, that we might have soft hearts before you, that you might soften our heart. You might bring us to that place of just yieldable, teachability, humility, that you might exalt us in due time as we humble ourselves under your hand. Lord, I pray for each person here tonight, Lord. They've come and they've labored through these passages, as difficult as they are to see. Pray that, Lord, you'd bring these things to their mind in the sense of having a healthy, clean fear of you, but knowing so great your salvation that you gave through your Son. How important that is.